Welcome to the Sibling Rivalry Podcast.
We are brother and sister, Josh and Noel.
This is the podcast where we talk about family,
family systems,
and everything in between. And I'll not leave it to behind. And friends, I'd like to say a few preliminary comments before I actually start the podcast. Number one, my friend Brian did this, and I think he'd be comfortable with me saying this is a kind of primer on the discussion of the exegesis of sexuality. If you're really interested in that, you should probably make a point to do your own reading and come to your own conclusions. The other thing is, if you're looking for like a kind of silver bullet on either side of the conversation so that you can win an argument, you'll probably be disappointed. That was not our intent in recording this. It was to have an honest conversation about these things. Beyond that, I'll say this. Over the years, I hear two responses from what I would call the traditional side and the progressive side. And the traditional response is usually goes along the lines of, well, this is what the Bible says. And the progressive response usually goes something along the lines of, well, Jesus is about love, so we must love. I think those are both good sentiments that are like the tip of the iceberg and arguments that can be substantial. I just don't find that often people take the time to substantiate those and do the work necessary to do that. So that, in part, is the spirit of this, to help you think through some of those things if those are your claims. I hope that you enjoy this. I'm not interested in arguing with you. Of course, when I post these on social media, you can post your comments. And I almost never delete things. If you get snotty, I will. But that's it. I hope you enjoy. Okay, listeners, thanks for tuning in. I'm here with my friend, Dr. Brian Gammel. Brian, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Brian, you did a Master's of Divinity at Duke Divinity School in Durham. And then you came this way to Waco and did your PhD in New Testament. You wrote in the Gospel of Mark.
That's right.
In what particular?
Mark's Gospel was, my focus was the Centurion's Confession, Mark 15:39, where the centurion turns to Jesus at his death and says, "Truly this man was the Son of God." So it's on more than just that verse, but I really try to look at why he would have said that and what that could mean, since it's a contested text. So I ended up looking at the whole Gospel of Mark, though, in the process.
Well, what form of criticism would you locate your dissertation under?
Both rhetorical criticism as well as narrative criticism, and especially narrative criticism.
Well, I'm going to get lost if I keep pushing us. This is not. We'll have to have you back another day.
Okay. No worries.
We're going to talk about the exegesis of sexuality for the sake of this discussion, with specific regards to how that's been thought about with the LGBTQ community. Let's start here, though. What's the difference between exegesis and hermeneutics?
Well, traditionally, exegesis is thought as bringing the meaning out of the text. So you look at the text, and you're trying to understand, what does the text mean? What did it mean in its original setting? How would the readers have understood it? Or alternatively, how would the author have understood what it was that the text is saying? Hermeneutics, then, is often thought of as the application of that. How do we take that idea and apply it or understand it in our own context? And I should note here at the beginning that even splitting these two is somewhat of a modern move. In the middle of the 20th century, Christer Stendahl wrote a really influential article talking about how we can look at what the text meant in the past, and we can also look at what the text means right now. And people can agree on the first of those and disagree on the second of those. And he basically argues that you should have different groups of people who are trained differently doing each of those spots. So so New Testament scholars, Old Testament scholars, those kinds of people would be tasked with doing the first, and then theologians and pastors to some degree would be tasked with doing the second. I don't necessarily agree with Stendahl, but this is standard practice in the academy. This is really what makes the split between biblical studies and theology not only possible, but it presupposes it. So
let me just push that for a second. And again, this is not why we're doing this, but is this further clarification, or is this misunderstood that, you know, postmodernism has kind of critiqued our ability to be objective and to not split those apart is at least to be a little bit more honest about that.
That's right. I mean, that's where I would lean. I would fall into that camp that would say that it's not really helpful to try to split that as a two-step process, that it's always ever a one-step process at the same time. But that doesn't get articles published generally, and yeah. it's not the assumption in the way that the academy works, because there is still an idea that there is something objective out there, that the text has a meaning. Maybe that meaning is located in the past, and I can find it in some kind of way. And there is something to be said about the desire for controlling interpretation. And so I also don't want to completely eliminate that, the good that comes from that.
Well, we'll probably detect this tension maybe most poignantly in the Romans text. We'll see. Perhaps in Leviticus too.
Well, and I just bring that up just to say as well that I think it's a mistake to think that you can come at exegesis and be completely objective, find a truth, find an interpretation, and only then in your mind or someone else's mind switch tasks and then begin applying. I don't really think that's what happens.
Because inevitably you'll have already done hermeneutics before you get
because
there.
You bring so much to the text. Part of what you're doing already is interpreting it when you do exegesis. And so to my mind, and I'm sure there are those who disagree with me, you already, when you're doing exegesis, you are also engaging your hermeneutic.
And often hermeneutics we don't even know we have.
Exactly right. The way in which we're interpreting the text and applying it. So I do think it is a good exercise sometimes to be able to try to look at it objectively or as though it was as though you could do that. I think that's a helpful exercise to engage in. I think it's foolish to think that somehow this gives us ultimate answers or some kind of objective rod that we can then use to measure someone else's application. So I just want to be careful about that.
Yeah, that's helpful because if nothing else, that buys us leeway in this discussion, which is quote-unquote on exegesis, if we want to get a little bit more.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, do you have particular care to how we do this?
No.
I have a plan, but okay. Well, let's start with Genesis 19. We'll just go canonically through this.
Okay.
This is the Sodom and Gomorrah text, 1 through 29 in chapter 19, if people care to read. I don't want to read all of that. I'm going to assume you know the story. I'll let you speak first, and then if I think I need to prod you in any particular way, I'll go ahead and do that.
Okay, right. So this is the story where we get the term sodomy and sodomite from, clearly, because the text has been read historically, at least since the Middle Ages, as a prohibition against homosexual activity, because here are individuals coming and they want to sleep with the people in the community, and it was thought that the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was homosexuality. At least this is how it gets read historically later. But almost definitely that's not the case. And I think that careful exegesis of the text would reveal that what is really at stake is not male-male sexual relations or female-female sexual relations, but a kind of inhospitality. In fact, this is the way it gets translated within Scripture itself. Later in the prophets, when they're referring back to this text, they don't use it as an example of how the sin of the city was, or the cities were, homosexual activity, but their failure to offer hospitality. And obviously, raping visitors would be an extreme example of inhospitality. So I'm not always caught up with the conversation in its current form, but I don't know of anybody who still uses this text, at least academically, as a prohibition against homosexuality.
So if somebody affirmed a traditional position of marriage within the church, this would not be a place to establish that, is your point?
I can't see how you would.
Okay. I did want to ask this, and since this is exegesis, the Hebrew word yada is to know, correct?
Okay.
Did I say that right?
Yada.
Yada, okay. This is a Wisconsin pronunciation. So this is very often gets translated to know.
Okay.
And the Septuagint then makes choices with the Hebrew. I have heard, I don't read the Septuagint ever, that the choice in the Septuagint to know in this Genesis 19 is not rendered sort of with a sexual intimacy. It's rendered more of a coming alongside and getting to know you. And I'm not smart enough to parse the difference between those sort of words in the Hebrew and in the Septuagint in the Greek. But I wondered if you had any comments on that, because yada is used 943 times in the Hebrew Bible, and only 17 of those is it used as a sexual connotation. And I know you've already disregarded this as a text. I was just curious, though.
I don't know that I have much to add to that. I've not I've not studied what the Septuagint does with it. I do think that that can be helpful as terms in terms of history of tradition or history of interpretation, how the text gets received by a different community. But I'm sure that's an argument you could use in addition to everything else that was just mentioned. But I don't know that I have really strong feelings about that.
So let me ask you one, I guess, maybe sociological question. The word sodomy has a specific connotation in our modern English vernacular, correct?
That's right.
But if we're going to let the prophets have the first exegetical word, that's not how they're seeing the word used. Is that right? Or is that a stretch?
Well, I mean, again, I'm not sure, but to my mind, and to my knowledge, I don't know that the word sodomy and sodomite gets used in the biblical tradition. I think that happens much later.
Well, I'll go ahead and offer us a quote here. This is John Boswell, who, if you do any digging in this, you'll hear his
Boswell.
Christianity, Social Tolerance, and Homosexuality points out that, and here I'll quote him, throughout the Middle Ages, the closest word to homosexual in Latin or any vernacular was sodomita, translated sodomy, has connoted in various times and places everything from ordinary heterosexual intercourse in an atypical position to oral sexual contact with animals. At some points in history, it has referred almost exclusively to male homosexuality, and other times almost exclusively to heterosexual excess. So, just to bolster the point of the ambiguity on this particular text.
That's right, and I would agree with Boswell here that the... I mean, this is not a term that I'm familiar with that anyone uses before the Middle Ages to describe anything. The prophets refer to this event and to this story, but I can't remember them using a term to describe anything. That happens much, much later.
Okay. I want to turn now to Leviticus. I'm going to read both 1822 and 2013 out loud, unless you have a preference of a translation you want me to use.
No, go ahead.
Okay, so here's Leviticus 18:22. You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination. Leviticus 20:13. If a man lies with a male as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall be put to death. Their blood is upon them. This is the word of the Lord.
this is obviously another kind of text of terror, I think, that gets thrown at a lot of the people in the gay community. And it seems really straightforward, right? It seems very clear that God's judgment is on homosexuals. That seems like a very clear reading in English when you kind of read it in isolation. The problem is that Leviticus doesn't really seem concerned with setting any kind of what we might call a moral ethic or an ethic of conduct, but it's concerned about purity laws. It's concerned about keeping things in their proper place. And so obviously people will point out all the time all the other things in Leviticus that we don't pay attention to. So it also says that a man shouldn't wear a woman's clothes and a woman shouldn't wear a man's clothes. It's also an abomination to the Lord. And I don't have the passage with me, but I'm sure you can find that. And so most people that I'm familiar with, and again, Old Testament is not my forte, but in my limited reading and training, my understanding is that most of the Torah in general, Leviticus in particular, is concerned with keeping things in what were considered to be their proper place. Don't mix things. Don't mix fabrics. Don't mix women's clothes and men's clothes. Don't mix sexual relations that should stay in the same lane with each other, because the world already was disordered. The world was chaotic, and this was a way of helping to order the world. Things need to stay in their lane, and this was a way of helping to control the chaos that was coming at them. But there's not necessarily a great rationale behind it. It doesn't seem like you can really discern a reason for why some things are kept separate and some things are allowed to commingle. Again, this goes way beyond my own competency and training, but that to me, that seems like that's the point of Leviticus. It's trying to organize the world, trying to keep the things together that in that cultural context should be together, and that men sleeping with men is simply one of those things. It's not seen as a prohibition against a certain kind of, it would be a prohibition. They wouldn't be for it. I think that's in that context, but it's not singled out because of its desire. And one of the things, of course, that I'm sure we'll talk about is that the ancient world didn't have a concept of homosexuality or sexual orientation the way that we do. The word homosexual is a 19th century invention. They didn't see it the same way that we see it. And anyway, I think Leviticus is not a great text for us to go to either. It's just not, there's not enough there, of course, to really have a full discussion on.
So let me try and argue both sides for a second. If you read it isolated, as I just did, it does seem to have a certain kind of strength.
That's right.
I think it also is, I think Hayes argues semi-successfully, has a strength in that it's explicit and it's used by Paul in 1 Corinthians 6. We can talk about that when we get there.
That's right.
I did want to, the two figures I have used for my research when I did this years back was Richard Hayes from Duke and then Peter Gomes from Harvard.
Okay.
Gomes is going to make several points. One is, you know, you have these obscure laws, which a few you've alluded to. You can't sow fields with mixed seeds. You can't have garments with two kinds of threads. And as you said, these all deal with purity. And he will say that this is also a time of this happens when they're what he calls the frontier community. They're on the verge of taking the land. And so I don't know if he comes around to saying this explicitly. There's a fear of assimilation. And so these kind of obscure laws are worth having because they're about identity. They're not about holiness per se. Well, they are about holiness, as Israel understands it at this point.
That's right. Well, I would say holiness as a means of identity construction.
Right.
That's the way that they understand themselves. And to reiterate the point I tried to make earlier, I think that the way that that's done is by ordering the world in a certain way. And so purity helps the world make sense. It helps the world that is chaotic and that doesn't have sharp lines and that has things mingling together. And honestly, when you're in that kind of an environment, that's very dangerous, right? We don't experience that on a firsthand basis, many of us in the developed world. But
I'm trying to think of an example. If I went to the Middle East as a woman and decided not to wear the head covering, right? That would be kind of a social taboo that here in the States we don't think is problematic. But it would be to ignore the context and to ignore the kind of law of the land that is about identity.
Well, that's true. And I guess my point was simply that you can see how a desire for separation and order arises out of a real perceived need. You don't mix salt water and fresh water, right? That's dangerous. That's dangerous to human thriving. You don't mix certain kind of animals together when you're, when you are in a pastoral environment. That's dangerous for you and for the animals. And so there is some of that makes sense, right? That civilization and human flourishing is only possible because we have certain kinds of order and separation. But you can build off of that basic premise or notion a separation about a whole bunch of things that don't necessarily really involve human flourishing, but maybe would seem like it to a certain culture.
I want to read one more thing. This is explicitly from Gomes, and I don't have the training to have a commentary on this, but maybe you don't feel like you do either. The reason I want to do it, though, is because the word abomination in particular seems to have kind of weight that certain words do.
Right.
So Gomes says the word abomination does not usually describe something intrinsically evil, such as rape, theft, but something that is ritually impure, like eating pork or engaging in intercourse during menstruation. An abomination is by definition what the Gentiles do, but that in and of itself is not necessarily evil or a violation of the commandments. Is that overstated? Is that understated? I don't have a...
No, I think this is really helpful, and I would absolutely agree. And I think this points out the degree to which when we visit the past, we visit a different world or a different culture. It's not the same. They don't think about things the same way that we do. And so we hear abomination, and we hear it filtered through, again, decades and decades of a certain connotation. And it's not to say the Israelites wouldn't have thought about those kinds of things with maybe the same severity that we do, but they would think about lots of things with that kind of severity. So whether it's mixing thread or mixing cloths or mixing certain kind of animals, all of those things would be seen as very dangerous and invoking God's wrath, but it's because of the impurity involved in it, because it invokes ritual impurity. And so, of course, for us, ritual impurity means almost nothing. It isn't. We don't live in a context where that has any kind of traction for us. We don't have any firsthand way, most of us, for really making sense of that. And so we dismiss it, right? So if we said, well, it's ritual impurity, it doesn't mean anything to us. It clearly didn't mean anything to the ancient Israelites. Well, I think that's the wrong way of thinking about it. it likely meant a lot of things to them, but that just shows the distance between where we are and where they are. So they might have thought that lying as a man with a man was an abomination in this really heavy way because it was ritually impure. But that's not the way that we think about it. And when we translate that from that text to our own context, we miss the offense that they would have had. Their offense is not that this was such an ethical issue, but that it was, again, a mixing of something. It was a ritual impurity. And that, for them, was a big deal. And for us, we almost have no way of making sense of it.
Okay. I now... Do you have more you want to say about Leviticus?
No, I think I'm done with
Okay. I want to move to Romans 1. I think you would agree that this is probably the text that we all need to reckon with, whatever our view may be, correct? I mean, this is the largest of them all.
That's right. I mean, I think that most people, I shouldn't say most, it seems to me anyway, that the conversation among many commentators and thinkers on this issue have all recognized that this is really the hinge text. If there's anything to be gained by proper exegesis and by true discussion, it comes from a helpful exegesis of this passage where there's a lot to be said. It's not a passing reference. So, yes, this is the heart of it.
And I mean, I'm trying to do this as neutrally as possible for listeners. If one were to arrive at a tradition or a position that affirmed the tradition, this would probably be your biggest ally. Is that right?
That's correct. I think that's right.
And maybe the other way, if one were to arrive at a position that disagreed with the tradition, you'd have the most work to do here.
I think that's right.
Okay. I don't want to read the whole thing. What I want you to do after I read 26, 27 is to unpack the context. And by that, I mean 118 through 32. Okay?
Okay.
So in terms of what Paul's doing about the creation and the larger context of 1 through 3 in Romans. So here's what Romans 1, 26 through and 27 say. For this reason, God gave them up to degrading passions. Their women exchanged natural intercourse for unnatural, and in the same way, also men giving up natural intercourse with women were consumed with passion for one another. Men committed shameless acts with men and received in their own persons the due penalty for their error.
Yeah, right. Well, there's a lot to unpack and to set that in context. And even the way that we set it in context is gonna matter. And so let me offer sympathetic readings for both kind of avenues of exegeting.
Sure.
That. So a traditional, perhaps conservative response or avenue for exegesis would set this up by saying, if you look at the beginning,
Romans 1:1 or 1:18?
No, 1:18, I'm sorry, the beginning.
Okay.
Of this pericope, that Paul is attempting to flesh out a history and a theology of why the world is messed up the way that it is. Because what he's ultimately wanting to do when he gets to chapter 2 is to charge the Jews with the same kinds of things that the Gentiles have done. But before he can do that, he wants to lay out why is it that the whole Gentile world doesn't know God? Why is it that they're alienated from God? So that all the people who are listening to him can say, yes, let's get them. Of course, they're terrible people, so that he can, turn the tables on them starting in chapter 2. That's a pretty standard reading.
And can I interrupt only because this will be helpful for my hermeneutical discussion next week with Jonathan Tran? The purpose of the letter is Jew-Gentile relationships.
Well, one of the purposes, for sure. Right. I mean, I it seems difficult to nail down, at least to me, one reason for Romans, but certainly one of the reasons that's sitting...
Well, and let me clarify that. So is it Caligula that kicks the Jews out of Rome and then Nero that rescinds this, that brings them back in, and that conflict and their return is the occasion for at least 12 through 16?
That's right. And that's a very plausible scenario and setting, and many people have used that as a really helpful window into understanding what's happening in Romans, especially at the end where... It depends on how you set up the parameters, but many people would see that that is crucial to understanding the context of Romans. He wants them to be united because he wants to go to Spain and he needs a united church to support him. He also wants to know that his efforts in the East have not been in vain, and so he's going to go back and offer the the collection to Jerusalem, and he wants that to be kind of a symbol of the unity between Jew and Gentiles, that he can go in confidence out to the west, out to Spain. I think that's a very plausible understanding for Romans. And so that's definitely at the background, okay. On one level or another.
I probably got you too far away, but thank you for indulging me. So chapter 2 is to be able to indict the Jews.
Right, and so chapter 1 then, in order to do that, he has to paint a picture of why the Gentiles are have all turned away from God. Why is the world the way that it is theologically? So he offers this explanation, right? He starts in 1:18, the wrath of God is being, let's see, let me turn to here. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. And so then he goes on to explain what has happened. People gave up the knowledge of God. They traded the knowledge of God for a lie. And in doing so, the result of that, the punishment of that, the judgment that comes from that is this kind of unnatural relationship. And so then that's the proper...
Unnatural relationship with God and humans, or with humans and each other?
Well, both. But they're ordered so that the unnatural or the wrong kind of relationship between God and humans results in the wrong kinds of relationships between humans and humans. So a conservative reading of this would say Paul is explaining why the Gentile world is messed up. It's why they don't know God. They at some point in the past rejected God. They traded the truth of God for a lie. And in doing so, their punishment for that, or punishment's even too strong of a word, the natural result of that, and you can see it as a punishment, is that they would have disordered relationships with each other. And for a Jew, the highest form of disordered relationship would be something that we would maybe call homosexuality today. Men sleeping with men, women sleeping with women. So that's the result of that. And so all of the Gentile sins that we see around us exemplified in this kind of male-male, female-female sexuality is the result of this Gentile turning away from God. So many commentators would point out that most of this that Paul is writing would be uncontested. People, other Jews reading this would say, of course. And that's the whole point of the passage, is for everyone to come in and say, of course, yes, they're terrible people. So that in starting in chapter 2, Paul can indict the Jews as well.
So it's a rhetorical trap.
It is a rhetorical trap. That seems to be the point of it. And obviously, there's different...
So let me, to again, I like language that summarizes the traditional reading of 1 through 18. Richard Hayes offers this phrase where he says that this example operates as a kind of sacrament of what he calls the anti-religion.
That's right. And he actually uses a phrase to describe this as, this is a mythico-historical story. So this idea that all the Gentiles traded in the truth of God for, it's not a historical truth. Paul's not referencing some event in history that we could pinpoint, but he's imagining this is a symbolic rendering of what history was like. So there is no point in history that this happened, but it's a poetic way or a symbolic way of describing what did happen over a long period of time, or what did happen with the Gentiles. It seems to be the way that, at least that I read Hayes on this.
Does that bring you to the conclusion of your traditional read of that section?
Well, I guess the last thing I would simply say is that to reiterate that for Hayes as well as for others, that whether that was a specific historical event or something that has happened symbolically for all the Gentiles, it is they're trading in the truth of God for a lie that results in the disorder relationships we see around us. And so most conservative commentators, I think, would point out that it's not a condemnation of homosexuality that is being discussed in Romans. It's not trying to target this kind of behavior as especially egregious. It's trying to point out that this thing that for the Jews is especially egregious is a result of something more foundational, more fundamental. So the point of it is not to condemn them, although in the process, it's using what all Jews would think would be condemnable anyway. So you're not arguing for homosexuality as something that's terrible and wrong. It's we already know that that's terrible and wrong. And how did we get to this point? Well, it's because of this thing that happened already, right? So it's I think that the emphasis is really important. And to be fair to conservative commentators, many of them will want to point out that this is not trying to go around and beat them in the head as some kind of a terrible, egregious sin that you need to be aware of, but it's just this result of something else that has happened. So that's where I'd want to end that.
Well, let me just do these both to give Hayes a larger voice. The genius of Paul's analysis, of course, lies in his refusal to posit a catalog of sins as the cause for human alienation from God. Instead, he delves to the root, all other depravities followed from the radical rebellion of creature against creator. I think perhaps equally helpful, if you do want to read this text, traditionally would be Casamon when he talks about Paul paradoxically reverses the cause and consequence. Moral perversion is the result of God's wrath, not the reason for it. And by that I mean if you're looking for a levity in terms of the kind of judgment that people want to seize when they read this text, may not be there in the same way that it's thought it's there at first glance.
That's right. I would agree with that.
Okay, let's go back now and have you think about the same verses through what would be, what word do you want to pick? Non-traditional, progressive, liberal, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, whichever the other side, however you want to describe it. Well, I found Dale Martin helpful here, so I'll use some of his thoughts on this. He points out, and I think this is helpful to look at these points, he points out that Paul has a history, a myth, and an anthropology that we don't agree with or really even have any kind of handle on as modern 21st century Westerners. So he points out that, first of all, this idea of history, that there is this initial fall from monotheism. So Hayes calls that story a mythico-historical kind of rendering. Martin's going to see it as straightforward history. And the reason he's going to do that is because he's going to point to texts like First Enoch or Jubilees that do describe
help readers who don't know First Enoch or Jubilees.
Oh, sure. I'm sorry.
Or listeners, sorry.
So First Enoch and Jubilees are ancient Jewish texts that were written after the close of the Old Testament, or what came to be known as the Old Testament. They're often considered intertestamental literature. That's kind of an older term for it, or the pseudepigrapha, which means falsely attributed writings. They're Jewish writings that didn't make it into the canon.
But they were consequential for Jewish faith in the
different
first...
Different communities found them really important.
Okay.
They were weighty for different Jews at one point or another.
Okay, so back to your point.
So these two texts do describe a kind of a narrative, a history, and in that history they describe this kind of falling away, that there was a time when the whole world knew God and worshipped the one true God, but then there was a moment when they rejected God, and when they rejected God, then there was this punishment that came on them. But the Jews didn't. The Jews stayed faithful with God, or God helped the Jews to remain faithful. However you want to read the story. So there are those kinds of stories in ancient Jewish literature, and Martin is going to say, well, we should probably think that Paul actually thinks this, that he thinks the same thing that they did, because they're all part of the same cultural milieu, right? They're thinking about it in the same kinds of ways, but none of us would posit that as actual history today. So that's the first thing that Martin would point out. The second is that, which is related to this, is this kind of mythology that homosexuality arose from polytheism, and this is again attested in those other texts we talk about, that homosexuality is a punishment for idolatry, or a punishment for turning away from God. You can see how you could read Paul that way, right? That God plagued the Gentiles with homosexuality. And so Martin's going to point out that, again, the way that we understand homosexuality today is much different. They didn't have a concept for that, of what it meant for men to have relationships with each other in intimate ways. They could only see it in these kind of specific categories. And the last thing that Martin points out, which I think is helpful, is anthropology. He says You know, when it begins to talking about desire and nature, it says, we think about sexual desire very differently than the ancients would have. So for the ancients, or for us, we think about today, homosexuality as a kind of orientation, that I have a certain kind of desire, a desire if I'm a man for other men and if I'm a woman for other women. Whereas if you're heterosexual, then my orientation is towards the opposite sex, right? That, and they don't really mix, although there's a spectrum, right? There's if you're at far ends of those spectrum, they don't mix with each other. But in the ancient world, that you would see it, homosexuality was seen as an excess of desire. In other words, everybody had a certain amount of sexual desire, but if you had too much or you had a whole lot, then having sex with, if you're a man, with women just wasn't enough to satisfy all your desire. You had to even go to other men as well.
So to give it language, it would be a problem of greed almost, or gluttony.
Or yeah, a kind of gluttony or a lust, you might say. There's too much desire. It's not a different kind of desire. It's too much desire. And that's the problem. So they have unnatural desire. Their desire is too great. And it results in what would be considered unnatural acts. And again, here, we hear unnatural acts. And we might think of something that's you know, opposed to maybe the natural law or the natural order. This is often the way that it would maybe traditionally be understood. And Martin points out that, again, this is not the way that the ancients thought about natural acts. For them, they assumed that the way that their culture was reflected nature, or was in tune with nature. And sexuality in the ancient world was very much connected to power. So the position even in sexuality mattered, whether you were on top or on the bottom, or whether you were penetrated or were the one penetrating. And so for a man to choose to be penetrated would be unnatural in that context, because you were giving up power. You were giving up your natural phallic-centered way of being in the world for something that doesn't make sense. But it wasn't because it violated some kind of natural law, but it violated the way that they understood power dynamics between people. So that's what he points out. So those three things, history, the myth, and anthropology, are the ways that Martin would reread that section and say, well, Paul thinks about this very differently than we think about it. And there's a very big bridge there between our understanding and Paul's understanding.
Yeah, I just have about a million questions go through my head, and I'm trying to think if I'm a listener. I don't want them to get overwhelmed. Maybe I can state it this simply, though. Is it true that in the first century, if I were a male with power and I desired to have a sexual experience with another boy or male, that would not render me as a homosexual as it might in the thought of the 21st century? That's just a sexual choice of many I might make. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Again, they didn't have that connotation in their head.
So nobody was asking in the first century, am I gay?
It doesn't seem like it. No, that's not a way of thinking about sexuality that they seemed like they conceived at all. You had sex with your wife if you were a man because you wanted to procreate. You needed children. You might have sex with men or with boys because that was almost considered, at least for the Greeks, a higher form of sexuality. It was, in fact, male-male relationships in general and friendships specifically were seen as superior to male-female relationships, which is different a little bit than the way we think about it. We really elevate the male-female, if you're hetero, the male-female kind of romantic relationship as being so important. This is why romantic comedies are play so well, because you're willing to sacrifice so much for that. But that's not the way that it was seen in the ancient world. You had a wife because you needed to have children, and you might love her and you might care for her, but that's not the not the end all be all.
So it's worth saying marriage wasn't thought of the same way either, alongside sexuality.
That's right, absolutely.
So I wonder, to make this explicit for people, and this is not necessarily the question we've posed, but it comes up in this conversation a lot. The question is, did Paul understand a committed homosexual relationship in the same way that we do? What would your answer be to that based on these two different reads?
Right. I can tell you that a couple options that exist, and then I'll give you my thoughts on it, I suppose. So some people will look at this, and one avenue we've not really looked at, one kind of progressive reading, is that what Paul is discussing here in Romans 1 is not just a blanket male-male or female-female kind of interaction, but a specific form of maybe temple prostitution or a specific form of sexual relations that would be exploitative, right? That would be disadvantageous for one of the parties involved. So people who argue that would want to argue that because they would want to make room then for a kind of committed, loving relationship between two men or two women. And that's an argument that gets thrown around for many on the progressive side in reading Paul. I don't think that that's probably accurate. I don't think it holds a lot of weight. I think it does a lot of mental gymnastics to get us to have Paul think about things the same way we would think about things. I'm open to revisiting those conversations, but it seems to me that the way that Paul thought about sexual relations was the same way that most other Jews thought about sexual relations, which is very different, again, than the way that we think about them in the 21st century. And I don't think that means there's not a progressive reading of the text. I think it just means that we want to be honest about what Paul would have thought about in his own cultural context, and to be clear-eyed about the vast difference that exists between us and him.
So let me give each line of thought some strength of reasoning, and then we can either move on or you can comment on these. So Gomes, for example, then is going to take these categories and break them down. Given a lot of what you just said about the complexity of sexuality in the first century, dishonorable passions for him are, this is this question, a question of control and prudence and temperance or whatever you want to call it, where dishonorable passions are those who just were overcome by their sexual needs of a variety of things, okay?
Okay.
The second thing, unnatural relations, then he talks about, he assumes, I think, if I understand him correctly, that whether or not people are thinking they have orientation, people do, and that unnatural is to act outside of whatever your orientation is. And then the third point is shameless acts. This is, I think, where he gets into the power dynamics of pederasty and some of these other things that happen in cultic prostitution. So I just wanted to offer listeners a way to think about that. The other thing I would say, though, then, is to come at it back the other way. I wonder, since Hayes presupposes, or at least thinks Paul presupposes, the Genesis narrative in telling the story of 118 through 32, that for him, it doesn't really matter the occasion for the kind of sexual choice one makes, because the image is male-female, none of that really has weight. Is that true, or is that a misread?
Help me understand that again. So I don't know that in Hayes's reading of Romans 1 that he would posit that Paul is thinking specifically always of the Genesis encounter.
Well, let me just read this. Okay. This is my summary. Hayes argues that the prior reference to Creator in 124 would recall the Genesis 1 through 3 story and subsequently establish the story as paradigmatic basis to make ensuing arguments. Said differently, Hayes is suggesting that Paul is making the God, well, this is, I don't even want to say this because it's, I don't remember if it's in the book or not, but sort of the rhetorical thing people say, or God made Adam and Eve, not. I just think they can be hurtful too.
Sure.
Argument, albeit in a less inflammatory and offensive way. And then he gets into the sacrament of the anti-religion. I just wonder if for that line of thinking, any of the nuance you want to offer just becomes inconsequential because of that sort of supposition. Or do you think that either Hayes is wrong on that point or that's not there?
And by that meaning?
The backdrop of Genesis 1 through 3 and the male-female imaging.
Yeah, I think it's difficult. I don't know. I do think that probably there is some of Paul thinking about that that description in Genesis when he's talking about male female. I don't know how you could avoid that. I also think that the more compelling reading seems to me to be Martin's reading, which is that Paul is thinking the same way that other Jews in the ancient world thought about things, and that even if the Genesis 1 passage is in the back of his mind, that's not what he's using to construct this history. Or another way of even putting it is the way that, and this goes to the way Paul is using his text. He may be reading Genesis 1 through 3 through the lens of a Jubilees or First Enoch story without being consciously aware of it, in the same way that we often read texts through our own kind of lens without being aware of the way that we're clearly this text means X, Y, or Z when it's not so clear.
Can you give me an example of that, either within or without the Bible, how we might do that?
Well, I think the opening discussion was really helpful when we talked about sodomy, yeah. Right? So when we talked about Genesis 19 and we think about the term sodomy and sodomite, well, that it seems so clear. It seems so obvious to many of us living in the West without realizing that there's a whole history behind how those terms got attached,
sure.
Where they come from, how the text was understood before it came to have its current connotation, right? That all of that is imported before you unpack it and realize that there's a history of interpretation that I am a part of. I'm a link in that chain.
So your comment is that perhaps Paul unknowingly has these assumptions that carry from these pseudepigraphal texts.
I'm saying that we would make him human. That would make sense historically. It would make sense of him in his context as a Jew. It would make sense that he would think about it similarly to the ways other people think about it. That's not to say that just because other Jews were saying, we're using these images, that Paul also had to do it as well. So, and that's why these matters are so difficult in interpretation, is because you don't know ultimately what he was thinking. All you really have is the text in front of you.
Okay, let's now turn to 1 Corinthians 6. And I don't know that I even had laid out the verse here. Do you know the specific verse? Is it 6:9-11? So it's a list of vices. Is that right?
Vices, that's right.
Can you read the verse and then put the two appropriate ones in their Greek forms? Because we're going to talk about them so much. And then render your choice of translation.
Okay, let's see.
Okay, Brian's flipping for those of you listening.
Okay, so 1 Corinthians 6. So he's discussing lawsuits, and he gets done with this to talk about how the communities, and it really the larger context we should mention is that all of 5 through 7 largely is discussing sexuality and illicit sexuality in the Corinthian community in general. But in this passage in particular, he starts in verse 9 by saying, "Or do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor," here's our word, the NASB renders it as effeminate, "nor," again, another word, "homosexuals, nor thieves, nor the covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. Some of you, such were some of you, but you were washed, you were sanctified, but you were justified in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ and in the Spirit of our God." Okay, so the NASB, along with many other translations, makes some choices on how to render these two words. And the two words in Greek are malakoi and arsenikoitai.
Malakoi was translated there as a feminine.
That's right.
And arsenikoi was explicitly homosexual.
That's right.
Okay.
And both of these words are very unusual, or I should say rare words. They don't occur very often, definitely not very often in the Bible. They reappear in 1 Timothy. And then I think Malakoi, I think, has one reference in the Gospels, in a pericope with Matthew and Luke, in a different form. And then even after the Bible, they don't appear much beyond that either. So there's not a lot of traction. These aren't clear words or obvious words that had a clear meaning. And so because of that, the translation of those into English becomes difficult because they're such rare words. So let's discuss some. Well, let me discuss first the context of the passage, if I can. All of this, like I said, 5, 6, and 7 is really discussing porneia. It's discussing porneia would be obviously it's where we get the word for pornography, and for Jews that would be any kind of illicit sexual activity. But also it was a metaphor for idolatry. And they were seen linked together, that to be idolatrous was to be someone who engaged in illicit sexual acts, and illicit sexual acts are going to lead you to idolatry or a form of idolatry. So
this is not unfamiliar with Romans 1.
That's right. It's
or again, unlike, I should
it's,
say.
It's the idea is similar. And I believe in Revelation, there are references made to those who are unfaithful, who are idolaters, and it uses the same term. So hearing this, this term in general, you would think of Gentiles. These are Gentile sins: idolatry, prostitution, illicit sex. But it's not defined. I think that's what's interesting about porneia. It's not defined. I don't go around explaining exactly what constitutes illicit sex. And so in this passage, in particular, Paul is pointing out the things or the kinds of characteristics, the vice list, and there's several of these actually in this section, a couple in chapter 5 and this one in chapter 6. He's pointing out the kinds of things that characterize those who will not inherit the kingdom of God. And he uses all these words, this kind of list. And so the fact that these two words are right there in the middle already indicate that they probably don't hold any kind of special significance. They're not the first of a list, and they're not the last that you're building up to. They're just words along with all the other words. So let's discuss malakoi first. So malakoi means soft, and here it's masculine, so probably soft ones.
When you say masculine, that's a lexical term.
It's lexical, right? And so we can render it substantively as the soft men or the soft ones who are men. But what does soft mean? Right? That's that itself is difficult. So in again, the section in the Gospels, I believe, where this appears, it talks about how Jesus is discussing John the Baptist, and he says, "What did you expect to find? Someone who had soft clothing out in the desert?" And he uses the term here that we read as soft. Here, their soft clothing indicated wealth. Right, so you would be someone who was wealthy, who had access to lots of resources, and your clothes would be soft, your skin would be soft, you didn't have to work. So soft ones there would probably be people who are rich.
So I think probably how one we were already confused is by our modern notions of masculinity and femininity.
Well, right. So obviously, when we hear soft, the question is, what does soft refer to? It can refer already to something completely unsexual, but even if we are going to refer to it in a physical or sexual sense, we render it through our own lens. But so did the ancients, right? So what would it mean to be a soft man? It could mean that you're rich. It could mean that you were effeminate.
Is there a chance that this is at all slang? A kind of slang?
It is possible. There's a lot of things that are possible with this word because, again, we just don't have a lot of traction to know what to make of it.
Okay. Well, and I talked to another friend who's in a sexuality class up at Bright this week about it, and he said that they even said that something like obesity could be considered soft because, again, it was a representation of the kind of wealth you had where you had the luxury to become that kind of a state of being.
Well, that's right. And think of what happens when someone is grossly obese is that their skin is soft. I mean, there's a softness to it. And you could imagine them both metaphorically soft because they don't have a hard will, maybe you might think. It's kind of a physiognomy. But also, they're physically soft. So really, what do we do with this term? It's really hard to make sense of.
Okay.
Effeminate is a possibility that you're talking about effeminate men.
But it would probably mean more than what we think.
It would mean more than that. And it's not at all clear that that's the only possible rendering of the term.
Okay.
Even if it didn't mean that, of course, the fact that it just appears in the middle of this is really, really kind of confusing. What does he mean by that? It seems like that this word is thrown in only to add maybe to the rhetorical, to the excess. Here's an example of all the people who won't inherit the kingdom of God, and we're adding other terms just to pile on what we already know. Like the addition of all these terms is not to give specificity. It's the whole point of these vice lists. They're not trying to be super specific about these kinds of activities. It's a cumulative effect that you hear all those together as a unity, that the kinds of people are like all of these things, that they're greedy and they're revilers and they're swindlers and they're thieves and they're covetous. It's a kind of characterization of what unrighteous people are like in general. So anyway, malakoi.
Maybe in different ways, these two items wouldn't stick out on the list to these hearers like they do for us having this conversation.
Well, that's right. It doesn't seem like it, at least. Usually, like the first term would be important. You know, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness. And maybe the last of a list might be really important. But the middle of them, unless unless they're marked in some special way, it wouldn't seem like it would be significant.
Okay.
Ars Inequita is even more difficult to describe. It's even more rare. It as far as I know, it's not attested at all before Paul. So it's possible that he coined this term.
And why might we have reason to believe that? And this is where I wanted to go back to Leviticus.
That he coined the term?
Yep.
Well, I mean, we don't see it before.
Well, I guess what I'm meaning is there's a suggestion that there's like a reading cycle in the synagogue where this Levitical text would have shown up. And even heard orally, there could have been a kind of conflation of terms. So what I'm getting at is the Septuagint rendering of Leviticus comes out to look very much like Ars Inequita.
Yes.
Meta arseno koiten genekos, you have to help me out, is the, I guess would be the Septuagint rendering of Leviticus 20:13. So taken together then, verbally heard in the temple, the thought is perhaps this could have been also slang.
That's right. That's a possibility as well. And so it is possible that Paul did coin this term. But the point to be made is that if that's the case, that this was not a technical term, and that's what's important about both of these. These were not well-known terms that had a defined meaning. So when we use a word like homosexual, we all know what that means. We know that homosexual means a certain thing in modern Western society. These terms would not have necessarily had that kind of specificity to them, regardless of what we come to understand. It was so it's really hard to know what this means at all, to be very clear. Most people eventually throw their hands up. It's possible it refers to people who are predators, who are the term really means men lying in bed with other men, or men in bed with men, or it's the literal meaning of the word is something along those lines. But are these predators? Are these men who go after boys or after the people who are exploitable? Possibly. But it seems like that for everything that we can find, and I don't want to get into the weeds, in the small amount of literature that's there, that even if it really does mean a male-male relationship, that these things were likely condemned for other reasons. Not because it was two men, but because it was maybe a man and a boy, or a man in power and a man not in power. Those seem to be the ways that the word tends to get used in other contexts. But again, I really want to emphasize, we're talking about possibilities on top of uncertainties. And so this is where the limits of exegesis come. We don't have enough information to really get a strong handle on it. So it is possible that these words do mean effeminate and homosexual in the way that we mean them. That is a possibility. It just doesn't seem probable. And that's always what we're dealing with when we're dealing with interpretation, is what is the probable meaning of a text. So the fact that these are mentioned in passing, they don't show up very often, they're repeated in another vice list in First Timothy, mean that they're really hard to make much sense out of. You just can't do much with them.
So I'm glad you said that. We're actually going to fold up the reading of the text now. And if you're interested in 1 Timothy, what is it, 1:10, Acts, 15, 28, and 29, and then there's a Titus reading? I can never remember. Anyways, all of those, my supposition is we folded those into this text.
That's right, yeah.
So we're not ignoring them. We just don't think they get anything. I want to do a few things in our last couple of minutes. Number one is, and I think you're the guy to try and answer this question as opposed to my hermeneutics people next week, how far into the world of the Greco-Roman culture is Paul, and how far into the world of Judaism is Paul? And I guess answering that is an argument from silence, but maybe consciously as he writes to these communities. And I think that's important because there are so many questions about sexuality in the first century that we're assuming Paul does or doesn't know about.
Yeah, that's a helpful point to make. So probably a mistake is to imagine that Paul is either in a Jewish context or in a Greco-Roman context. All of the Mediterranean basin world kind of shared a similar perspective and culture, and the Jews shared in that as well, even though there were certain things that they resisted, or they had a special way of understanding things that was unique to them. They still shared many of the same assumptions. They weren't hermetically sealed off from those ways of understanding the world. And so The way, again, that sexuality was understood in that context is very different than the way it's understood now. It was seen generally through a power dynamic. And the kinds of things that we would just assume about sexuality and what's proper and what's not proper would not have been there in this kind of context. So, for example, just to give you one example, if I was a patriarch of a family and I had a slave, whether it was a male or female, then for me to have sex with that slave would have been permissible. Regardless of gender. And they were seen as a body at my disposal. And it would not necessarily have been seen as me being unfaithful to my wife. It's just me taking advantage of something at hand. Now the Jews, they probably would have had a little more compunction about this. One of the things we discussed the other day is the reading in 1 Thessalonians about Paul talking about everyone having their own soma, their own body, available to them. And, you know, some have argued that that meant that Paul was okay with that, that he basically said, hey, you need to have your own vessel, your own way of discharging your sexuality. But probably more likely, even though that's a plausible reading, probably more likely Paul took the position that men, just like women, needed to have no sex except for sex inside of marriage. And even then, we should point out that Paul's own understanding of sexuality was different. He saw sexuality within the Christian community in many ways as a concession. If you read 1 Corinthians 7, we see that he says, you know, it's better to marry than to burn with lust, right? So again, it's the idea going back to that sexuality or desire is this kind of this passion that builds up in you, and it can blow up and it can be really dangerous. And so find a way to contain it or find a proper channel for it, like getting married. But the preference, he says in this section, is that all of you would be like me. And of course, Paul here in this section almost certainly is referring to his celibacy.
And we have a friend who makes this, points this out, that the highest ideal is actually not heterosexual marriage in the Bible. It's celibacy.
That's right. And I think that a strong argument can be made that that's what Paul is thinking.
Is it then improper to theologically suggest that marriage of any kind, heterosexual, though, so we'll grant that because the tradition is granted, is not necessarily, obviously not sinful, but is it thought of even within the tradition as lesser? Isn't it an accommodation by God?
It definitely comes to be seen that way in the early church, where you have examples, and I'm sure Dr. Wilhite can speak to this. You have examples of couples who are married, Christian couples, and they decide they're going to have a celibate marriage, where they continue to say married, but they have no sex with each other. And they see that as a higher form of their marriage. They're devoting themselves to God. But you see the seeds for that in discussions in 1 Corinthians here with Paul, or even in the Gospels where Jesus talks about everyone being made like a eunuch. So you can see how those traditions develop. And it does seem like a plausible case can be made to say that there was a hierarchy, and at the top of the hierarchy was the ability to be single, to be celibate, for the kingdom.
Okay, we're getting along, so I'm going to cut out one question I had. Maybe we can record something else and let people go listen. I wanted to ask about Eugene Rogers' argument that the Gentiles are unnatural and grafted in the same way that unnatural is used in Romans 1. I think that's an exegetical question that turns into a hermeneutical solution. Don't answer that right now, but think about that.
Okay.
What I do want to do with our last couple of minutes here is say, I want you to, as someone who's thought so much about this, to name what you think not even the biggest strength of argument, but maybe to look the other way for someone who might have a traditional conviction about marriage, what is the largest thing they need to reckon with? And conversely, if somebody wants to read with a non-traditional view, what do you think is the thing that they need to reckon with the most? Both of them, if they want to be exegetically faithful to the text.
I guess I would say the same thing for both of them, which is that there is a tendency to want the text to say what you want it to say, which of course is very, very natural and straightforward. But it's what exegesis should help us do is to be honest first with ourselves, and then with others about what it does seem the text is saying or what the possibilities for the text. I mean, texts don't always just say one thing. They don't just always have one meaning, but they don't mean anything. They don't have unlimited meanings. And so being honest with ourselves. So for the conservative or the traditionally minded person, I would say that the distance between our culture and their culture is to be remembered. We can't easily appropriate these words or these ideas without thinking about how it would have been heard and understood in a radically different context. And to the progressive, I would say basically the same thing, which is we want to be able to deal with the text as we have it and not the text as we would want it. And so how many mental gymnastics or how many hoops will I jump through before I will recognize that I've done violence to a text? And I just have to admit that maybe it doesn't say what I want it to say. And that doesn't mean, I think, for either one of those people that they give up their convictions, but maybe what they have to do is they have to understand that this exegesis isn't going to support what they want to say. And obviously this issue is bigger than exegesis. The way that we arrive at opinions about this is not simply a straight line from what did the Bible say back then, how do we think about it now, how are we going to apply it. I think that's facile. People reach convictions based on their moral intuition, on the voice of the Spirit, on the experience in the community, on theological traditions, as well as exegesis. So it's a component of that. But I think that we need to give up the idea that only by answering these questions first do we then move and figure anything else out. That's perhaps what I would say to the conservative. And then to the progressive, I would say that the text is not unimportant. And let's just at least be honest about what it does say.
Brian, thank you so much for giving me this hour. You're a man of great knowledge.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, here the streets aren't paved with gold, and downtown's under snow, and the people watch the sky when